What up, what up, what up, America? How y'all doing out there? Thanksgiving, baby. I know you're full of turkey, right? You're feeling good. The belly's nice. You voted. You got turkey. What more can you ask for? Christmas. It's coming. All right. We'll get to that later, but I'm glad you guys could join us today. So excited to have you here at the Michael Steele Podcast. Again, hope everybody had a wonderful holiday. You know where to find us when you do that download thing. It just adds to the flavor of the turkey, baby. Let me tell you, you know, you can find me on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Apple. Do the download thing. Makes me happy. But I got to get that in because I just do. But anyway, we're excited about today's conversation because this brother is one of those guys back in the day. I would watch him on MSNBC. I would watch him on various channels and I would cuss his ass out. He would drive, this boy would drive me through the roof. I'm like, oh my God, this is, and then we got to work together and I got to know him and I still wanted to cuss him out, but he's just a good brother. He just is. He's one of the smartest, most erudite individuals I've met. And trust me, I've met a lot of folks out there. He's none other than the honorable, the great Professor Michael Eric Dyson, academic, author, preacher, radio host. He's an all about town kind of guy. He's a professor of sociology at the Georgetown University, my alma mater, or at least one of them.
I just moved to Vanderbilt.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. You just moved. That's right. You just moved to Vanderbilt. I stand corrected on that.
All right.
His newest book is really why we wanted to have him in the conversation today. Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. Just released this week. He is also the author of over 20 books dealing with subjects such as Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Marvin Gaye, Nas's debut album, Illmatic. Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, that's back in the day, man. All right. Bill Cosby, Tupac Shakur. He is culturally, politically, socially relevant. Just an all-around good guy. Dr. Dyson, welcome to the podcast.
My man, Brother Steele, Chairman Steele, it's great to be here, my man.
So this book, man, in these times, it just strikes chords. I mean, it just out of the box starts striking chords, reckoning with race in America on the heels of the tragedies that we've seen this year with the murder of George Floyd, COVID-19 and its disproportionate impact on communities of color, and the race politics behind that. Walk us through Long Time Coming and how you assess right now this reckoning that we have to have on race.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, May 25th was a game changer for this nation in a very serious way. That's the night that, you know, the evening that George Floyd lost his life beneath the knee of Officer Derek Chauvin and the other knees of, you know, knees also of other officers, you know, Officer King and Officer Lane. We didn't see them when we saw the video because we only saw Chauvin on his neck, but there were people on his back and his legs. Right. And so here was a man laying prostrate on the ground, begging for his life. They ain't running. He ain't shooting nobody. He ain't creating no issues. He's not trying to hurt the police. He's laying there helpless, and they refuse to let him up. He tells them he can't breathe. They don't care. And I think that callous disregard for life, that sadistic racial animus against black folk that came out in that event, sparked a lot of anger and hurt and trauma among black people, but a lot of other people were outraged as well. A lot of white folk were like, you know, black people been telling us this, but you know, and we've seen a couple of the videos and we figured y'all must have done something. Y'all just slapped the guy off camera or something, but right here is clear. The man is laying there, ain't nothing he can do. And I think a lot of white brothers and sisters for the first time got awakened. Now, you know, people can judge. Dang, you weren't awake when Eric Garner, you weren't awake with slavery. You weren't awake with Jim Crow. You weren't awake with post-Reconstruction. You weren't awake with the Civil Rights Movement, and on and on and on. Hey, people wake up when they wake up. Yeah, we can argue about it, but in the meantime, let's go. Look, you're awake now. Thank God. Here's some stuff we can do. We can transfer that outrage that led you to hit the streets with what you do in corporate America, what you do at your university, what you do at your home, what you do at your job. And so I think the awakening that occurred in that day, yeah, it's subsided some of the intensity now, but it can't remain the same level forever. People are not going to stay up at 10 forever. They're going to come down to 4 and 5, but that's where the real work gets done. The real work doesn't get done at 8 and 9 and 10. That's the inspiration. The real work is the unsexy, everyday stuff you got to do to make sure this nation is better.
But Michael, that's we've been there before. We marched. There were dogs, police dogs, water hoses. We've had that come down to 4 and 5.
Yep.
And yet here we are 50 years after King marched, and you've got George Floyd, you got Breonna Taylor.
Right.
Here we are 100 years, you know, after Reconstruction, and we have, you know, Proud Boys and Charlottesville.
Right.
And a president of the United States who's now given license to all of these narratives. So when you talk about this reckoning,
right,
I think the question still is out there. Okay, I got it, but y'all know everybody's going back to sleep, right?
That's right. That's what happens when you wake up. You got to go to sleep. But see, we got to set them alarm clocks because you got to wake back up again. You know what I'm saying? It'd be different. Look in your own life. Do you want to wake up one time? No, that means you would have died at 1 day old.
Yeah.
Keep waking up. Every time you go to sleep, you want to wake up again. So being woke ain't it's like conversion if you're a Christian. Okay, you got converted one night in 1975, Saturday night. I got the Holy Ghost. All right. But Negro, if you ain't getting converted again and again, I don't know if it really took that first time.
Right.
So the thing is, especially when it comes to me, Baptist preacher for 41 years, but we'll save that for another podcast. Right. So the thing is that, yeah, you woke, but you go to sleep, but you got to wake up again. You go to sleep, you got to wake up again. And so let me tell you something.
It's the action then.
Come on, it's the action. It's the constant reaction. It's the constant waking up again. Because look, as tough as we think it is, being Martin Luther King Jr., now I've been out here all these years. I've been preaching and I've been marching and I got stabbed and I went to Chicago and they threw a rock and hit me in the head. And he kept on going, Doc. So, look, I mean, you closer to him than me, but we don't have the same kind of, you know, troubles, trials, traumas that he endured. And he kept going. And he kept getting up. And I figured we can't complain if he didn't complain. He wanted to wake us up. He wanted to say it's time to wake up. And even in 1955, 1956, when he started, you know that black people were going, how many times we got to tell these white folk this? They were saying it then because they had done it a lot then. So the thing is, you're right. I'm not denying that you're right,
right.
But I'm saying we have got to be persistent and vigilant, and we got to seize the opportunity when it comes. You can never dictate when history will erupt. No, wait a minute. What made George Floyd different than Eric Garner?
Right.
Why didn't people get it then? Well, one thing is the pandemic that you talked about had us at home on our screens.
That's right.
We were already paying attention, like, okay, I'm doing this, doing that. What's on Netflix? What we going to get on HBO Max? What?
Right?
We would have seen it anyway, but a lot more people saw it more immediately, and it hit them. And the pandemic had already made people know, wait a minute, even though there were some people who were going off the rails with this, taking guns to state houses and getting mad when they found out that it was attacking black and brown people disproportionately, a lot more white people said, man, the virus that seems to be indifferent to anybody's, you know, nature, race, is hitting black and brown people more. So they were already sympathetic, those who would be sympathetic to us. And then when they go, wait a minute, you can't even suspend your usual malarkey, as Joe Biden would say. You can't suspend your usual horror of killing black people. You're doing it during the pandemic, too. That struck a nerve that woke white people up in a way they hadn't been before. I ain't saying it's great. I'm just saying that's what it is.
But I don't know if they're really woke. I don't know if they're really woke. And we will see. We will see how woke they are. I've always contended, my friend, and this is to clarify my opening about my cussing you out on the television screen. So people are clear, that was over policy differences between the brother and myself, which is important. I mean, because that's the space that white folks, you know, tend to want to play in when they get to talk about, you know, tax cuts and tax increases or the environment or gun control. But beneath all of that noise, mm-hmm. and because that's what it is, I actually, to some degree, think it's a distraction, and it has been for 401 years.
Right.
Because beneath that is what I think race in America, reckoning with race in America, gets to, and why you appropriately titled this Long Time Coming, because it is a 401 year journey. It is something that while we may make a reference point to King and Malcolm and to others, it goes back to 1619. And y'all can crap all over the 1619 Project all day long. Right. It still don't change history. It still don't change how we got to Virginia and what happened 15 minutes after we were here.
That's right.
So how does that fit into the core narrative of reckoning as you see it in your book, with against this, the other narratives that people would like to distract to? That's the going back to sleep part for me, when they start talking about all these policies and all these differences. And at the end of the day, Black folks still are disproportionately represented in the healthcare system. They're disproportionately represented at, misrepresented in the economic system. That we won't even get into the penal system, which you so ably wrote about in One Love, Two Brothers, Three Verses. Mm. How do we pull all these things together to get white folks to not go back to sleep on the narrative?
Yeah, that's you brilliantly laid that out, man. I'm going to take you on the road with me, Doc. So promote and talk about this book, because you're saying it better than I can. But you're right. It doesn't just go back to Malcolm and Martin and I, you know, or go back to... Ella Baker or Clark or Joanne Robinson or Angela Davis or James Baldwin. It goes back further. Goes back to Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells Barnett. Goes back further. Frederick Douglass. Goes back Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. And back, as you said, to those 20-some-odd Negroes who were extracted from their resting in Africa and brought here to Jamestown and forced against their will to work. Mm-hmm. And for 401 years, we've been doing it. And you're right. It is frustrating because we've been here before. We said we were reckoning after Emmett Till. We said we were reckoning after, you know, the advent of other lynchings going on. James Reed, the white minister, but Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman. Oh, my. Do something. After Medgar Evers. Oh, my God. We got to do something. After Malcolm. After Dr. King.
King, yeah.
Oh, my God. We got to do something. We've been saying that forever. And it rises, it crests, it shows up, and then it subsides. And I wish I could tell you, oh, well, there's a different way. That's just what it is. That's how it happens. Look, that's how it happens in marriage, except for yours. That's how it happens. How long you been married? What you doing? What? Are you still in love? Yeah, honey. Y'all must be newlyweds because we done worked this thing out on another level. So, white folk, you know, every now and again, they get the romance of racial resistance with us. That's what George Floyd was. That was one of those moments of, oh, baby, remember when you used to go steady and we would go out to the park? That's the romance, Doc. Every now and again with George Floyd, and they went to the streets. They were dating Black people again. They were coming into the streets, arm in arm with us, and even dying for us in Kenosha. Black Lives Matter people, the people who are dying, a lot of them are white folk.
We're white, yeah.
So here now, the romance of race. Then it's going to go right back down into the everyday. You ain't brought her no flowers. You ain't brought her no chocolates, except on Black History, which is Valentine's Day. They in the same month. We're going to give you a kiss. We're going to hang out with you. And the rest of the year, we pretty much going to ignore you, get on our phones, try to say we love you. But that ain't what it is. So that's what race is. And we got to look for those moments of intervention. We got to look for those moments of pregnant pauses. We got to look for those moments where we can exploit it. I wish it was different, but it ain't. And since this is what it is, we have to extend it as much as we can. Yes, what you brilliantly said. Every word that ends in system, people talk about systemic racism, then deal with the system, the penal system, the criminal justice system, the economic system, the healthcare system, the public education system, the school system. All those systems is what you got to deal with. This ain't about whether you call me the N-word. I can forgive you for that. What can't be forgiven is the daily horror and hurt and punishment that you impose on Black people every day. Remember, Martin Luther King Jr. had moved to Chicago. And he was in the hood with the people, like in the real, real hood. And look, his kids had to leave after a little bit. Now, y'all going to have to go home because I'm not taking that back talk. You out of your damn mind.
Right.
I'm not violent, but I'll get up in that. No, he didn't say. So look, it was having an effect. He was like, look, just living in the hood, in the slum for a month. Then got these kids off. They rockers. So, but he's going out the house one day, and he's with one of these guys, and they're going to the protest, and a white boy spits on the guy he's with, and he's ready to whip his head. You know he is. And Dr. King said, now, this is what I don't understand. You mad at this, but every day you're paying more rent than you should be paying. Every day the water doesn't work. Every day the housing is messed up. But you're looking at spit as the symbol of disregard when every day you are being slowly killed.
So
that's what we got to deal with are the systemic things that are much more difficult to get at, less sexy, but real.
Ties that into, and you segued without even knowing it, right into the Black Lives Matter moment. Because when you go back 4 years, 5 years, to the bending of the knee and the reaction of the community to the point you just made, and by the community, I mean by white folks, right. The broader community of white folks, looking at that exploited by President Trump at the time, they took offense at the symbolism without understanding the meaning of the action, that the action was actually out of respect and calling attention to the underlying issues that would cause a Black man to take a knee in that moment.
Right.
No one bothered to ask Colin Kaepernick and those other NFL players, so why'd you take a knee?
Right.
Okay,
right.
I understand you took, okay, that made me feel kind of uncomfortable.
Right.
And I need to know why you did that.
That's right.
They just reacted to the moment.
That's right.
And to the point you made before, here we are now 5 years later, and they're walking with those same Black Lives Matter protesters. Now all the white folks are trying to get Colin Kaepernick a job. But the work still hasn't been done. That's my point. It's like Black History Month, 4th of July, and Valentine's Day all rolled into one. Oh, yeah, we're going to march now.
Right.
Do you really still understand why he took a knee in the first place?
Most of them will not, but a few will, and we got to deal with what the few do. Because Donald Trump ain't but one man.
Right.
But my God, the impact he has. And we know also, you know this better than most people in America, Donald Trump was produced out of a particular kind of womb. He didn't produce the womb. He's the product of the womb.
Right.
When we get rid of Donald Trump, we ain't got rid of the problem, which is what your point is.
Yeah.
Your point is that there's still this deeply entrenched aversion to Blackness that's going to survive Donald Trump. I wish we could get rid of it with Donald Trump when he got to pack up and leave up out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and let Joe Biden roll up in there. And for all this talk, you know, all these, whether Democrat or Republican, talking about how bad and how they are economically, all of y'all living in public housing.
That's right.
What 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is, dadgummit. You ain't paying no rent. So the thing is that you're right. But we hope with every moment of reckoning that enough people get it in that moment. I wish it was institutional memory that they could pass on. Some do. But for the most part, those who get awakened in that moment make a difference in the moment in which they live. And all we can hope for at best is that there is a profound enough reckoning with enough people in positions of authority and power to make huge differences. That is joined with the kind of, I keep saying it, but the unsexy work of the ordinary stuff. We need public organizers. We need social organizers. We need community organizers who are out here doing their thing on our side, on the black side, and hopefully on others as well. But on the white side, what we need is people who will go home to their own communities and take a message of transformation that Michael Steele is and Eric Dyson is. They ain't gonna listen to us. I don't care what we do, how funny we are, how self-critical we are, how willing we are to reach out to white folk and try to get along. They don't care. So what we need are some white allies and some white Trojan horses who will roll up into their communities and be all accepted because they looked the part, and then they open up the gift and out comes, wait a minute, I thought you were a white person. Where did that W.E.B. Du Bois quote come from? My Lord, where did that Malcolm X, what? Martin Luther, what? He's not Caucasoid. What the hell happened?
Right.
And we need enough white allies who are complicitous with our job, abilities, our vocations. A John Brown here or a Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, as you mentioned that. The two brave white brothers in Kenosha, Wisconsin. White folk all over this country ever since George Floyd who are taking to the streets. We need white folk to act up, to misbehave in the most elegant sense of that word. Not, you know, unlawful to the degree of trying to hurt and harm anybody, but trying to challenge the hegemony and the dominance of a white viewpoint that refuses to wake up. And here's my belief. Enough white folk will get woken up, as the hood said. They'll get woken up enough that when they're awake, they'll do what they got to do. Martin Luther King Jr. said, preached that sermon, remaining awake through a great revolution. He talked about Rip Van Winkle, you know, taking that Washington Irving story, borrowing. Right. Let's say he sampled it. We'll be kind.
Yeah, we'll be kind. Right. He borrowed it.
That's right. He borrowed it heavily. But
with every intent to give it back.
No intent, brother. But look, it's just like that Chase a Rabbit here. When Martin Luther King Jr. was found to have plagiarized, as he did, I hope I'm not shocking anybody, writing, they went to the white man whose dissertation he had heavily plagiarized, Jack Boozer, and they said, Dr. King stole your dissertation. What do you feel? He says, I regret that's all I could give him. I wish I had more to give him, man. The white man said, I wish there was more stuff. I have but one country, but one dissertation to give to this man. So, because he's doing the work. So King said, you got to, like Washington Irving's story, Rip Van Winkle went up the mountain and went to sleep for 20 and came back down and was a new king. And he said, you got to remain awake through a great revolution. We're begging white folk, remain awake like us. Because when we talk about being woke, we ain't been able to go to sleep for 401 years. That's why we got sleep apnea. We ain't been asleep for 400 years.
Well, and to that point, one of the more profound and I thought important moments that occurred, because it crystallized for me, Michael, it crystallized everything it to the point that I just remember tweeting, oh my God, I get it. When Kimberly Jones, we know her, she author, actress, screenwriter, activist, had this video moment that went viral in which she asked the question, how can we win?
Right.
How can we win? When the system is stacked against us, how can we win? And she went on to make the point, which I thought so profoundly at the end of that video. She went on to say, you're lucky that what black people are looking for is equality and not revenge.
Ooh, doctor, that's it right there in a nutshell.
Hello.
That's
and
it.
So right there. I have to tell you, Michael, I thought of that when your book, The Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, because that for me is the coda to the points that you're making,
right?
Is that what you white folks don't get is right. That after 401 years of your shit,
come on,
seeking revenge,
right,
for what you have done to our people.
That's right.
Because that's not how we're built.
That ain't how we are, man.
We are God-centered, God-fearing people.
And that's why I wrote in my book about cancel culture.
There you go. Go with that. Tell us about that.
I can't get with it, man. And look, I'm on the left, you on the right, you know, but the reality is, you know, that we understand together. You still a black man, which is what I love about you. Regardless if I disagree with you policy-wise, I know as a human being, your character is sterling. Mm-hmm. You are a man of your word. What you say you gonna do, you gonna do. You stand up for your people. You don't back down. You call the BS when you see it on the right, the left, the center. It don't make no difference. You gonna do what you gotta do.
Yep.
And so when I look at cancel culture, I'm going, no, people, that ain't the way. Mm-hmm. Right? Because I know what you're doing. I get it. You want justice. Because you are so frustrated. The courts ain't delivering it. The culture won't acknowledge you. So hey, we got this thing called cancel culture. We can get your butt on the internet and we can just cancel you. We can destroy your job. We can take your livelihood. We can remove you from being able to take care of your family. Or we can cancel you thinking we're wiping you out. Now, that might work for Harvey Weinstein. That might work for Bill Cosby. That might work for R. Kelly. But what about the masses of other people that you end up getting canceled? Most of the people getting canceled ain't powerful. If you got enough cancel power, cancel Donald Trump. No, tell you what you got to do. You got to vote him out. The only canceling you can do is do it through a system that allows you to pull a lever and they start trying to work against you there with this voting disenfranchisement. But despite that, or as the brothers in the street say, irregardless of them trying to dadgum destroy the vote for us, we showed up and we showed out. So my point is, cancel culture is seductive, but that's about. And let me tell you, that's why I think that black people are not down with those movements ultimately. Ain't but a few people. Black Twitter ain't but a few black people. Right. It ain't most black people. So stop misrepresenting who's on Twitter. Most black people, what the hell? Twitter, I was Twitter last night. So I just thought of that right here on the Michael Steele.
That was
the best out of me. So the thing
that's
is,
pretty good. That's pretty good.
I finished the book and read it. That's what I did, son. What you talking about? Google. I Googled her last night. Okay. So the thing is that we believe in justice, not revenge, restorative justice, that's not retributive justice, right? Even when you kill 9 of us in a church before the society forgives you,
right,
we will forgive you.
We do.
Now, we don't want to be punks, right? Punked and so on. Right. We believe in holding people accountable. If you go to jail, you be held accountable. But black people said, I'm not going to carry the burden of hating you in my heart. And so much of cancel culture repudiates the elegance, the moral elegance, and the beautiful eloquence, ethical eloquence of black people that say, I know what you did. I hate what you did. I want you to be held accountable, but I'm not trying to erase you. And if God gives you the opportunity to say you're sorry for what you did, I'm going to receive you back. Ralph Northam in Virginia, black people were like, let's cancel him. I said, and they called me up. I said, heck no. Let me tell you why. Ain't nothing better than a white boy who messed up, who got power, who knows he messed up and owes you. Even Biden said, hey, I owe you. What president has ever said, including the black one? Hey, y'all hook me up, I'm going to hook y'all up. What?
Right.
Is my TV, wait a minute, did something happen? Did the president-elect just say, thank you, black people, and I know I owe you, and I got your back because you had mine? I ain't heard no president ever say that. So the thing is that we are about the issue of real justice, real reorganization of the logic of relationships. We don't want to kill you. We want to hold you accountable so that another day coming in the future, you have the possibility of redeeming yourself. Ralph Northam went on not to retire, not to resign as governor because he was caught in blackface 20 years ago, though, dog.
Right.
I'm not saying, all right, it was dumb when he did it. It was racist when he did it. But the man, what's he thinking now? Have you never done anything 20 years ago? But you weren't on camera and ain't nobody caught it. You know you done messed up. So be forgiving because you have been forgiven. And so when we operate with that ethic, when we go into the world, we can transform it and change it far more quickly than a darn cancel culture and trying to delete somebody. And I tell these young people, you ain't got no cancel culture. You ain't got enough money to have a subscription to a magazine. You can't cancel your magazine subscription. You ain't got nothing to cancel except that ignorance about cancel culture. So that's why I write about it in there, because of the broad principle of love, of justice, of recognition for the other that has threaded itself through our culture.
So, folks, you just got a taste of why Isabel Wilkerson referred to this brother and his book. long time coming, reckoning with race in America, as crushingly powerful, unfiltered, unfiltered marble, how she put it, unfiltered marble, black pain. That's what you got a taste of just now, folks. That's why you're one of the leading voices that brings together, synthesizes this culture, politics, race, society, peace in a way that very, very few do, Michael. And just not blowing smoke. You are a powerful spokesman for these times in ways that I think people need to pay attention and take a listen. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up with some words about what happens next with the great Michael Eric Dyson right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody. We got Michael Eric Dyson with us, and we're talking about the book, the newest book out this week, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. Professor Dyson, as you look at where we are, a president who's basically barricaded himself in the White House, and as I envision it, sitting in his underwear, rocking in the corner, saying he won. Mm-hmm. But then having minions go out there and repeat that lie over and over again. Right. You have an incoming president who's trying his best to find that reckoning moment to help the country move forward and begin to heal and begin to deal with these issues, that many of which you touched on. How do you see America repositioning itself in a Biden era? Obviously, the historic nature of having a Kamala Harris at his side, we get all of that, and that's important. But we know it's much more than the symbolism. We talked about that, touched on that a little bit about having the love notes but not doing the work.
Right.
How do you see the work going forward as you sort of draw out in Long Time Coming? Continuing to come to grips with the reckoning, yes, but then doing the work so that there's actual result.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a $64,000 question. And I think, you know, a guy like Joe Biden, hired, elected, chosen because he wasn't Trump, number one. That means he wasn't out of control. He wasn't disrespectful to the other. He reaches across the aisle to try to speak to people. He reaches across the chasm of ideology within his own party to embrace the progressives who helped get him there, as well as some more conservative voices that he thinks are critical if we're going to govern in an effective fashion. But beyond that, I think on the everyday level, Joe Biden gets it. And it's no replacement for getting it. And what I mean by getting it is where you grow up makes a difference.
It does.
How you grow up makes a difference. And can we tell the truth? I mean, Joe Biden knows a bunch about black culture.
Yeah.
And this is why older black people, and I consider myself 162 years old, older black people, even though I feel young and
you're looking good, brother.
Thank you. I ain't looking as good as you, but you know.
No, we hanging on the same number, buddy. We're hanging on the same number.
Like I said, not as good as you. But so when you think about the fact that Jim Clyburn basically saved that man's presidency, and he knows it, and Biden knows it, and black women who saved the election, right? It was a 1-2 punch, but it wasn't no election to save unless Clyburn had saved him.
That's right.
And so older black people weren't torn by, you know, well, he said some stuff about busing. What white boy didn't say no crazy stuff about busing back in 1970, 71, 72, what? 75. Oh, well, he was on the crime bit. What? I was there. Negroes were like, you better do something.
That was the point.
You better arrest these Negroes. They out here killing us on crack cocaine. What you doing, president? They were pushing Bill Clinton.
Yep.
Look, a bunch of state senators, a bunch of congresspeople, a bunch of black pastors Stop lying. Don't put that on the white boy. You were doing it too.
Yep.
I ain't absolutely saying it was right, but I'm saying it, the real deal is y'all were asking for that too.
Yep.
So, but at the end of the day, Joe Biden, despite whatever guffaws and gaffes and everything else he done, people trust his heart.
Yep.
He's
yep.
a good and decent man. And he's got enough technocratic knowledge. He is a policy wonk. He understands the internecine workings of what has to be done in order to get stuff effectively passed.
Yep,
so you got to deal with the COVID-19 because that's killing a lot of black and brown people. You got to talk about economic disparities that continue to consign us to the bottom of the totem pole, and especially entree into the middle class by owning a house. The housing bubble burst, and it bled off the greatest amount of wealth for black people in the history of this. The educational disparities that we deal with, the criminal justice disparities, just those things alone on an everyday level will help right the ship of state in terms of sailing with interests of black people in its wind. And I think every day Joe Biden will be able to prove and prove again that he's serious and committed. And people may not agree ultimately with him ideologically or in terms of policy, but they won't be able to doubt his sincere commitment to trying to get it done. And I think on the everyday level, that's great. And let's look at the goodie. Look at the bonus. He done set up the first woman who's going to become president. I don't care what y'all say. She's going to be the first president, dog. She's going to be the first female president in the United States of America. And he gave us that hookup just by selecting her as his running mate. So on so many levels, I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are doing an incredible job already just giving us a sense of authority. Of respect for authority, authority in the sense of
Sure. Recognize
the power actions of a government and what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to handle it. Not calling people names, not being petty like this megalomaniacal president we have who stands up every morning to excrete the feces of his moral depravity into a nation he's turned into his psychic commode. Stop crapping on us. Bring the toilet paper. And I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are bringing the toilet paper to wipe the butt of America clean.
There you go. All right. Okay, that's one way to look at it. You may not want to
hand or butt about it.
That's right, right. You may not want to look too closely, but that's one way to look at it. So that's an interesting way to put it because you do talk about confronting the ugly truth of the systemic racism in this book, and that's very powerful and very important for you that we have that confrontation with that ugly side of our ass, if you will, you know, to continue that theme that, you know, as my mom used to say to me, boy, don't you go out there and show your ass. Well, America shows its ass quite a bit on the issue of race and racism.
Right.
As we kind of move to that point in the conversation where it's reflection and it's also, okay, what do I do next? What is my call to action? How do you see that, Michael? And how do you talk about that in the book, where you at once can help make us confront the systemic ugliness and realities of our own racism?
Right.
Point out, yeah, unlike what our mama told us to do, we do continue to show our ass.
Mm-hmm.
But there is hope. You talk about that. You do point to some avenues, some steps that can be taken regarding social redemption in that regard. What walk us through a little bit of that thinking for you your sort of homage to what we can do and what we should be doing.
Well, I think, first of all, doing what we're doing here is important. I never will forget I was on a panel with Taylor Branch, who wrote a tremendous mm-hmm. trilogy about Dr. King and the America that made him, produced him, and that he remade. And we were sitting there, somebody asked a question, what are we going to do besides talk and all this? And he said, you know, most of the time, Dr. King spent his time doing just what we're doing right here, mm-hmm. talking,
mm-hmm.
thinking, organizing, trying to use words to match realities, to transform the world. He didn't spend most of his time in the street marching. Those were episodes and interventions. The daily ritual of King was reading and thinking and reflecting and talking and trying to move the needle. And we have the same obligation to try to figure out how to move the needle, how to change America, how to transform the world. And words are critically important. How you think about stuff is important. How you talk about people is important. How do you talk to people is important. So when I think about the nuts and bolts, when white people ask, what do I do? What do we do next? Because black people always know what we're doing. We just got to keep getting up. Because every day we fight in this battle where we are. You know, even when it ain't official, we fight in a race battle, even when it's not officially called that. When LeBron James said, I'm going to leave leave Cleveland and go to Miami, they burnt his jersey. That was a race conversation. We just didn't call it that.
Mm-hmm.
People were mad because they were sports fans, and I get it. But some people were mad because they thought they owned a Negro, and you can't do what you want to do, you know? And so we have all
kinds of— What you mean you going to Miami? Hey, nobody told you could do that.
I got no permission. Who the hell are you? So when you think about what we do on the daily, black people are often always doing that. But white folk, I think you got to do a couple things. First of all, as I said earlier, but let me make it more explicit. When you go home for Christmas or Hanukkah and whatever you're doing, and you hear some untoward stuff coming from your mama, your grandmama, or your cousin, mm-hmm. or your nephew or niece,
mm-hmm.
you call them out for what they're doing. Now, get the Christmas dinner first. Watch the game. Don't be crazy. Get kicked out the crib since you ain't got no cable. And they got cable.
Right.
See the basketball game. So at the end of the night when they acting a fool, or as my daddy said, cutting the food,
mm-hmm.
then you challenge them in a way that I'll never be able to, in a way still will never be able to.
That's right.
Where you are in your intimate spaces of white secrecy, where is incubated and gestated black anti-black animus, anti-black feeling, and you know it, so don't argue about it. So that's number one. Number two, in your institutions, figure out ways to make them more just. And white brothers and sisters, y'all know what it is. See, because one woman wrote, who was the former dean of business at Rutgers, she said, racism now ain't so much about what things white folk do against black people, it's the stuff and others. It's the stuff they do for themselves they don't do for nobody else.
There you go.
Remember that Saturday Night Live thing that Eddie Murphy was talking about? When he played a white man, he's a white banker. He's going around talking, you know, black people, nope, I'm sorry, can't get the loan. Nope, can't for the banker, can't get the loan. And then when he came to the white person, you can take all the money. It doesn't make a difference. Just take it all. You know the hookups you getting. You know the things you getting in. You know you bitching about affirmative action when your dumbass uncle ain't got no brains and got through a school that he didn't deserve. You know the story.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
Stop lying.
Stop pretending.
Stop pretending and act like Ira Katz Nelson when he wrote that book, When Affirmative Action Was White. Y'all been getting the hookup. So right. Acknowledge that and do for black people what you inherently and instinctively do for yourselves and other people. Treat black people like they white for a year. That would revolutionize America. And then thirdly and finally, you know, what we all have to do together is find out how to combat our own peculiar idiosyncratic bigotries. So if you black, and you've been a victim of white supremacy, and if you black and you ain't been a victim of white supremacy, I don't know if you awake. But, and I don't mean, because then I don't mean just calling you the N-word and dogging right. you out, all of these subtle other things. But having said that, if you turn around then and go to your church and try to dog some gay people or some lesbian people or some poor people, you know, and I know you got your theology, and I know y'all don't want to hear this, but dadgummit, stop it. Just stop it. Now, you can have your own theology, but your civil rights got to be in order. I disagree with your theology, too, but having said that, don't be trying to reproduce the pathology of bigotry that you're trying to escape. Mm-hmm. And so now you're trying to introduce it to another black person because they female, because they gay, because they poor. Don't do that, right? We got to talk about race and not race only. Race and class, race and gender, race and sexual orientation,
right.
race and geography, race and region, race and religion. And when we do that, we don't create more victims in the name of fighting oppression. You know, look at the March on Washington. No women were allowed on that stage except for Mahalia Jackson, who sang. And earlier in the day, Josephine Baker got on there because she was French and she didn't know. She was like, look, I'm going up on the stage. Right. Oh, cherchez la femme ici maintenant. Son doux. Bissou mon derrière double. But anyway, so like, I'm up on the stage, homie. But the rest of the women weren't allowed up on stage. So even as you fight oppression, you're reproducing the oppression against women. So let's figure out ways to be self-critical, to be introspective, to figure out how we can also police our own bigotry, our own bias, our own sense of injustice, and challenge it from within. And then we'll be more sympathetic. Then we might be more sympathetic to white folk. Look, I get how it's hard to change. Your uncle thought this way, and you've been reared that way. Because I just stopped listening 2 days ago to rap music, to calling woman a bitch, or
calling That's right.
Oh, God dang. Well, how much just be jumping you? Now, we know there are structural differences. We know white supremacy is far more pervasive than that. But I get it. But you get my point. That a lot of us got to be awakened, woken up, and find out who we are, and we should be therefore loving and compassionate and not judgmental and hostile. And if we do those things, I think we are on the way to making a huge difference in the culture in which we live.
The book, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, the author, Michael Eric Dyson, academic, author, preacher, radio host, and just all around smart man who just has his finger on the pulse. Michael, tell us where you can get the book. I know Amazon is one shop. You can go there. Any place else? You got a website?
Well, I'm in D.C. Well, go to stmacmillan.com, Macmillan Press. You know, you can get it. Uncle Bobby's, a black bookstore there in Philadelphia. Mahogany Books in D.C. Order off of their lines. Of course, you know, you can go to Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. Just go somewhere. Don't steal the book. Buy the first 5 copies. If you buy 10 copies, then you on your own after that.
Right.
Y'all help a brother out.
We're going to help a brother out.
Like, and eat like Michael Steele when I grew up. So I need some help, y'all.
Well,
help,
look, I got my copy. My goal is to get you to autograph it and sign it for me when I see you next. But between now and then, my crew over here at the Michael Steele podcast wish you every success with this, man. I think it's an important story. Yes. I think it's an important narrative. Absolutely. But I think it's just important for listening and learning, like you said, and understanding exactly what's at stake here and why this effort that we're now having to confront in the various ways we see it is a reckoning. And it is a long time coming, and we have to go through it. And you have laid out for us with a high degree of clarity, as a necessary guide to help this country reckon with race. And so I commend this reading to everybody. And it is such an honor, man, to have you on the podcast, and particularly right at the beginning of the launch of the book. That's respect for me that I won't forget, and I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, my man. It's always an honor to hang out with you, and a real privilege and pleasure.
I appreciate it. All right, folks, that does it for this time together. You know where to find me again. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, do the download thing. You make a brother feel good. As Michael said, help a brother out. Go get a copy of Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. And don't forget to download the podcast. When this is out, share it with your friends, because we want to spread the word. The reckoning is here. The reckoning is now. And guess what? It is being televised. It is being podcasted. It is being social media. You can access it and be a part of it. All right. Thank you all. Till next time. Peace out, and wear the damn mask.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Mm-hmm.